Hello, friends. This is the AlphaList podcast. I am your host, Toby. The goal of the AlphaList podcast is to empower CTOs with the info and insight they need to make the best decisions for their company. We do this by hosting top thought leaders and picking their brains for insights into technical leadership and tech trends. If you believe in the power of accumulated knowledge to accelerate growth, make sure to subscribe to this podcast. Plus, if you're an experienced CTO, you will love the discussion happening in our Slack space where over 600 CTOs are sharing insights, or visit one of our events. Just go to alphaList.com to apply.
This episode is proudly presented by Rock. Anyone who has ever built a web app knows the problem. The first steps are always the same and cost a lot of time. Choosing the right tech stack, setting up the infrastructure and the app, the development of login, user management, notifications, mailing, payment, or chat. People like to build things from scratch, but it always takes longer, is quickly annoying, and involves unnecessary risk, not speaking of the money. Fellow CTOs, we should stop developing the same thing over and over again. With Rock, spelled R-O-Q, you get a simple yet powerful and flexible, customizable Kickstarter application on day one. The Kickstarter application is open source and available via GitHub, and you only code your business logic on top of it. All important features such as login, user management, notifications, mailing, chat, payment, and many, many more are already integrated via API. Your individual and powerful web application is live faster than ever. The modern tech stack is designed to scale and developers love it. If you want to build a web application faster than ever, just visit rock.tech/CTO, roq.tech/CTO. All listeners of the podcast will get the entire suite for free for the first 3 months. Welcome to the AlphaList podcast. I am your host, Toby. And today, my guest is really legend. He's, I think, almost 70 years old. Are you 70 already, Bob?
No, not quite. That'll be in about six more months.
So maybe like in the group of older guests I have here. I said he's legend. He's like author of a variety of books. One of the founders of the Agile Manifesto and so on. Maybe, Bob, you can take over. You can explain that way better.
Oh, heavens. Yeah, sure. So, let's see. I've been a programmer since 1964, I guess would be the right date. I was 12 years old. My mother gave me a little plastic computer for my birthday. It was 3 bits, all mechanical, no electronics or anything. But it could do basic logic work, and that little machine fascinated me to the extent that I became a programmer and stayed a programmer for the rest of my life. I've been involved with lots and lots of projects here and there, you know, lots of embedded real-time work and batch systems. I wrote some COBOL in the old days and some Fortran and PL1 and lots of assembly language and C and C++ and Java. And oh, my goodness, we could go on and on and on with all the languages and the systems and the frameworks and stuff that I've used. I've been around a good long time.
And can you tell me why? I mean, why you do that?
Why? I love it. I love it. I mean, it's what I want to do. They should find me with my nose stuck between the keys of the keyboard because it's what I like to do.
Yeah. Is it the focus or, I mean, is it the deep focus, the state of flow or like why?
Well, there's a challenge to solving problems. That really gets me. I like that. I like to be able to think through a problem and solve it and get into all of the details and, you know, sort it out. But as I have grown older, I find there's also a beauty in the way you structure those solutions. It intrigues me greatly. And every time I move into a slightly different language or a slightly different platform, there are new challenges to solve and new ways to approach the problem. So it has never failed to keep my interest in the 50 some odd years that I've been doing this, over half a century. So, and you know, the technology has grown enormously. You know, when I started, it was punch cards and big machine rooms and core memory. And now, of course, you and I are conversing over a world-spanning network that can transport gigabits per second. And I'm on a laptop that's got terabytes of RAM. Tremendous amount of change that I have seen in my life that continuously keeps my interest piqued.
And right now, what is your core interest? Like which programming language really hits your buttons?
I am programming in Clojure at the moment, which is a Lisp derivative. I was late to get into Lisp. I started this about 12, 13 years ago. And for a very long time, I had thought that Lisp was just an academic, nonsensical, mathematical language that nobody cared about. And then I actually started studying it and realized that I think in the end, it will be the last programming language. Everyone will eventually be programming in Lisp because it's the only language that actually makes any sense in the world. So that's where I am right now. And I'm focusing my efforts on social network kinds of applications that are free from censorship and free from centralized control, that are peer-to-peer and able to support free speech across the planet.
Well, that's a big task. And you don't do it commercially, but as open source, I guess, then?
Oh, yeah. It's just a way for me to pass my time. And I think as an industry, we need it. Perhaps as a civilization, we need it. We had free speech on the internet for a very long time, and it got sequestered. The big tech companies came in and very gradually took control. And I think it's time for us to take that control back.
Okay. And speaking of Lisp and the different concepts of programming, I mean, there were like a few trends that you could follow or you didn't. There's like, yeah, I mean, the decade of Java and really like object-oriented programming, like really becoming a trend, and then functional programming. And like some of them were very academic, like functional programming was always like, from my perspective, more in the academic space. And then got more mainstream with like Erlang and Elixir and so on. How do you see those trends? And you think it's just trends and it will go away again? Or
oh no, not at all. In the software industry, we go through these popularity trends, right? And the best thing you can do with those is ignore them. See, oh, everything must be agile now. That's a trend. Everything must be functional now. That's a trend. Everything must be object now. You know that you are involved with a trend if the name of the trend becomes synonymous with the word good. Then that means you can ignore it because it doesn't mean anything. What's behind it, however, is very important. So functional programming is something that every programmer should know. Object-oriented programming is something every programmer should know. And more importantly, if you are a programmer today, the programs you should be writing should be mixtures of structured programs, object-oriented programs, functional programs. These are not mutually exclusive ideas. They work together to form a synergy that a good programmer looks at and says, okay, I can take advantage of all three. I can mix them and understand how to create a system that is best supported by all of these ideas.
And what do you think is, or how much power should a programmer have about like selecting the right weapon of choice? I just remember like, in my Slack chat, a CTO once wrote, does anyone know an Elixir developer here? Someone chose Elixir and I don't know why. And the only one who knew it is just gone. Like, how do you think about that?
For a very long time, I have thought that the best way to hire programmers is to ignore the languages that they know. because languages are ephemeral. They come and go. It's not hard to learn a language. If you've got a project and it happens to be in Elixir, well, you don't need to go out and hire Elixir programmers, right? You need to go out and hire programmers, good programmers, and then they can pick up any language at all. The time it takes to pick up a language is very short compared to the time it takes to master programming itself. So it's always a mistake, in my opinion, to go out hunting for the programmers that know Java. That, you know, that's just dumb. Right? You know, find programmers who know how to write code in any language, hire them, and you'll be much better off. We go through these fads and these trends in languages, and to some extent, those are marketing ploys. People need to stir the pot in order to get some new product or new idea front and center in everybody's brain. But a good programmer looks at that and goes, yeah, whatever. Yeah, I've seen that one before, 20 years ago, 30 years ago. It's just, you know, old stuff getting rehashed. So it's not a good idea to be focusing on the hot new trends all the time. You should know them. You should be aware of them. You should look for the advantages in them. But you shouldn't be guiding your career based on them.
I partly agree. I think, like, yes, a good programmer can start in any language and get like become good in any language. The question is always, like, does he want to be good in any language, right? I mean, let's say you chose Ruby as your stack. Like, I'm a Rubyist. I like it still.
Sure, great language.
Maybe, like, you don't attract the right people if you say, yeah, my stack is Ruby. Come on, join me. Learn Ruby. I don't mind if you, whatever language you come from, that might not attract people at all these days, right?
Well, so now you have to think, do you want to attract people who are only interested in particular languages? What's going on in that mindset? Oh, I'm a Ruby programmer. I don't program in anything else. You might not want that person. That person's got a problem. That person's for sure got narrow focus. Oh, Ruby, that is the only language. You know, you might want people who can look around and think, yeah, Ruby's great. I like it. It's got these advantages and these disadvantages. And then there's Groovy. Groovy's kind of cool, too. I can program in that. Clojure, I can do that. I can do Java. I can do C. You want me to program in C? I can program in C. You know, we can do all these things. It is probably a mistake for a programmer or an employer to get hung up on the languages.
Right. You're right. Well, you're partly right again. I mean, speaking of complexity, if you have a company with, let's say, an umbrella that covers like 200 languages, it could become very complex to manage, right? And then this happens that like the only Elixir developer just left and you have a problem finding someone motivated who wants to learn Elixir or replacing that part written in Elixir that no one knows about. Like, how do you think about the complexity part of it?
How is it possible that the only Elixir programmer left? Why, if you have a substantial project and it's based in Elixir and you only have one guy, what's wrong with that picture? Now, yeah. One thing I'm pretty sure that you are not doing is you are probably not pair programming. You are not mob programming. You are not sharing knowledge between programmers. Because if you are sharing knowledge between programmers, you would automatically have N Elixir programmers, everybody who worked with that original guy who knew Elixir. One of the ways to run a successful software team is to make sure that the software developers do not isolate themselves in funny little silos. Right? I'm the Elixir programmer. I touch all the Elixir code. I don't touch any of that other goopy, horrible code that everybody else works in. That's a very unhealthy attitude. Everybody on the team should have a nice, broad experience. They should be able to touch the Elixir parts. They should be able to touch the Clojure parts. Maybe they should even be able to do a little assembly language. I also don't want people focusing in on particular avenues. I don't want the GUI guys. I don't want the database guys. I don't want the middleware guys. And it's okay if you know the GUI better than you know the middleware, but you should know the middleware too. And it's okay if you're a really good database guru, that's fine, but you should know how to do a little GUI work too. And it's fine if you're a Java programmer, but you ought to be able to do a little Ruby. What we don't want are these, you know, narrow specialists. And if you're creating a team that incentivizes that kind of specialization and does not focus on the sharing of information between the members of the team, you're headed for trouble. You're headed for that last elixir guy to leave.
What do you think about the modern trends? Let's not start with microservices. Let's start with like web apps and single page web apps. There you often have that challenge that the backend is written one language and the front end is written in another language, and you introduce a lot of complexity because you do, for example, like form validations and on both ends. You have to synchronize, you have to like to talk to each other. And some might not like the front end at all, even if he knows or she knows the JavaScript a bit, but having the state in the browser and so on might be a bit scary. Like what do you think about that? Like is it a good trend, or is it only that like Google makes us do that because they can afford such complexity? What is it?
So you've called it a trend. Yeah, it probably is a trend. But is there anything wrong with the idea of having a front end and a back end in different languages? And the answer to that is no. I mean, there's nothing wrong with that. Your team is going to want to be able to deal with those languages. And what you don't want to do is separate the team into the front end part of the team and the back end part of the team. You want the people on the team to understand the system, not the parts of the system, the system. Without a system view, the entire thing can fall apart in really terrible ways. So it's very important that the developers on the team understand how the information flows all the way from the first click of the user to the last insert into the database, right? Everybody's got to be able to understand those flows, understand the problems. You know, when do we need transactions? When do we need to lock? When do we need to validate? How are we validating? How do we make sure that the business rules on one side are consistent with the rules on the other side? All of that stuff is very important for people to have in their heads. Generally speaking, a team will have a team leader or an architect or a group of team leaders and a group of architects who hold that knowledge in their head pretty well. And they should be experts on all different aspects of the system. And the individual programmers who are not as senior, shall we say, should be learning that broad mindset from those leaders.
You recently did a talk on expecting professionalism. What is it about, and which level of professionalism can I as a CTA should I as a CTO expect from my team?
What level of professionalism? So we want our developers to be professionals, but what does it mean to be a professional? So what does that word mean? And it means that you profess something. You are a professional. You profess something. What is it that we profess? We profess disciplines, standards, and
ethics. I think ethics.
Ethics. I knew it started with E. Thank you. Thank you for telling me what I think. Yes, we profess disciplines, standards, and ethics. That's what a professional does. What are the disciplines, standards, and ethics that we have in our industry? And we have not defined any. You know, in the 70 some odd years that software has been around, we have not attempted to sit down and decide what our disciplines are, what our standards are, and what our ethics are. And so it's very difficult to call ourselves professionals. Now, one of the things that I think we've been trying to do over the last few years, the Agile movement, for example, is a movement in this direction, is an attempt to define disciplines that have some kind of ethical standard behind them. So the Agile Manifesto is a kind of ethical statement. The practices of Scrum and extreme programming are a kind of discipline set. And there's some standards hidden in there that we haven't fully articulated. But if you think about disciplines like test-driven development, right, there's a standard hiding in there somewhere. The standard that we test everything. We don't ship code unless we actually test it. That would seem to be a reasonable standard. Yeah. So that's what I mean by professionals. And when we're looking for people to populate our teams, we're looking for people who want to have that professional mindset, who understand that software is not a 9-to-5 coding job. You don't just do it to earn your paycheck. You are counted on to uphold a certain level of ethics and morals and standards and disciplines.
And when you initially came up with the Agile Manifesto, was there like a certain reason you said to yourself, like, we need this discipline, this minimum level of discipline, we need to have that, and we need to build a manifesto on that? Or like, why did you do that initially? Were you just annoyed of the standards or the lack of standards?
Well, no, I don't think we had even thought about standards or ethics or disciplines at that point. Although I have to say that Kent Beck and Ward Cunningham and people like that had been focusing on disciplines, but not necessarily standards and ethics. That was kind of beyond that. The thing that really drove the Agile Manifesto was this wild frustration, this mounting frustration that for several decades we had been pursuing a set of very high ceremony processes that just weren't working. And you could collectively call them all waterfall, although there were a whole bunch of different names and a whole bunch of different processes, but they were all very high ceremony and they required documentation and phases and dates and all kinds of very elaborate mechanisms for proving that you were following the process. And those of us who had been involved with that for decades were now old. You know, we were all in our 50s and 60s and things like that at the time, and thought, you know what? We've been doing this the wrong way. And there were a bunch of ideas that began to percolate right around 1995 of doing things in a lightweight, easy way. And so a bunch of us got together. We called this the Lightweight Process Summit. We got together in Snowbird, Utah, and we just kind of brainstormed. And it shouldn't have gone anywhere. Nothing good should have happened. Right. Because I've been to dozens of meetings like this and they all end in, you know, oh, it was a great meeting. Thanks. And we all go away. And that's the end. Something happened at this meeting that doesn't usually happen, which was a fundamental meeting of minds. The people in that group disagreed with each other on just about everything. I mean, you think about it. We're a bunch of consultants, right? We have to be, you know, arrogant and opinionated about everything. And we had guys from every background. We had waterfall guys in there. We had guys who hated process. We had extreme programming. We had Scrum. We had all these different mindsets in there. And we all we didn't like each other very much necessarily. We're all arrogant consultants competing with each other. And in the midst of all that, there was this moment when all of a sudden we were looking at the board and we see these words on the board, which nobody's sure who wrote, oddly. And all of a sudden it's like, oh, that's why we're here. And it was those four lines of the Agile Manifesto sitting on that board that appeared there magically. Nobody knows how they got there. And all of a sudden it's like, I see why we were here. And the purpose of that meeting kind of congealed and we knew we could go home. And Ward Cunningham said he would put up a website that people could sign. And this was very early in the web era. And, you know, signing a website was a brand new idea. Tens of thousands of people signed the website. We knew we had a problem on our hands.
And did you follow up on that meeting, or what happened?
We did not do much to follow up on that meeting. The website got put up. The Agile Manifesto website got put up. We wrote up a few documents after that, principles. You know, I don't think they really mattered much. And after that, we kind of walked away from it. The entire batch of us said, okay, we put it up on the website. It's up there. It's fine. And people can do what they want with it. But we're not going to be the leaders of some grand movement. It was actually a meeting that took place a year later where most of the original signatories just walked away and said, nope, it's open source. Let anybody do whatever they want with it. That was the end. And apparently the world did whatever they wanted with it because it's been quite a movement. But we're not and never were the leaders of that kind of movement.
This podcast is proudly presented by Moya. If you are at my age and live in a city like Hamburg or Hannover, you most likely already used Moya to get from A to B. It's the coolest mobility concept, ride sharing through comfortable electric buses. I use it a lot. The key question that Moya folks ask themselves is, will sharing get us to the climate goal? Will our grandchildren still know what a traffic jam is? And how human does autonomous driving actually think? To check out what moves and drives them, they built the Moya Mission websites to give insights into the Moya mission and how they are advancing the future of mobility in our cities with ride sharing. Simply go to moya.io/mission to learn more.
And if you could kick up like a new movement today, like what are you most annoyed with? Like what is the maybe like a set of principles you would like to like set in stone these days? Like which kind of rules would you ideally like to come up with these days? Is it?
Well, at a detailed level, I'm a big fan of the testing practices. I like testing, test-driven development, or some of the other ones that are similar to that. It seems to me that that's something that the community of professional programmers should adopt as a fundamental discipline. You know, gee, we test our code. What a thought. But more expansively, it seems to me that as an industry, we need to promote professionalism. So we need to promote the ideas of discipline, standards, and ethics. And so far, that's not really happening. You see a little bit of it in some of the books and some of the articles, and there's interest in certain circles. So we'll see what happens with that. But that's where I think we ought to be going with this industry. I think we're going to be forced in that direction by our societies.
How do you work in agile environments in the year 2022? Like, do you, for example, do code reviews, or do you do pair programming? And that's what I was asking for, or like maybe hinting that this could be maybe the good manifesto to come up with if I was you.
Yeah, you know. So I'm not a big fan of code reviews, since you brought that up, having done, you know, thousands of them, and realizing that, you know, most of the time they're pro forma and don't really achieve much. And I'm a much bigger fan of pair programming, mob programming, collaborative style programming where you've got people equally engaged in the production of the code. I think that is a much better approach to the problem of, you know, getting multiple eyes on the code. Do I want to make that a rule? I'm not sure I want to make that a rule. I think there ought to be groups of people who say, we make this a rule in our group, and other people have a different idea, and they make a different discipline a rule in their group. And then these groups can battle it out, and we can figure out which one is the best. I like the idea of, you know, a dozen flowers blooming.
So, and you think like a minimum set of like quality standards for modern teams wouldn't be a good idea? Or
Well, I'm not interested right now in a universal set because I don't know that we understand what that universal set ought to be. But I am very interested in the idea of different guilds or different groups or different factions coming up with their own and then figuring out, you know, through the normal market process, which ones work better than others. So I would prefer that kind of approach, a guild approach rather than, you know, the central organization on high has told us that it must be test-driven development forever. You know, I don't think that's a good idea.
what do you think about, to be a bit more concrete again, what do you think about technical depth, and do you have any rule of thumb that worked in a team that you led or you went with to fight technical depth efficiently?
There's two kinds of technical debt, as there's two kinds of normal debt. There is the debt that you decide to enter into rationally, and you know how you are going to pay it back, and you know the cost of it. You know the interest payments. This is the kind of debt you get into when you buy a home, for example. Then there's the kind of debt that the teenager gets into when they've gotten their first credit card, and they rack up, you know, many thousands of dollars because they think the money's free and haven't quite figured out that they're going to have to pay it back. The teenager technical debt should never have a place in any software team. No software team should run crazy off just throwing gobs of code into a system in hopes that it'll work. And I don't care if you're a startup. I don't care what you are. There is no excuse for that kind of behavior, just as there is no excuse for the teenager to rack up $10,000 worth of credit card debt and then pay 15% interest per month on that. On the other hand, there is an argument for looking squarely and painfully at the problem ahead and realizing that you are going to have to use some suboptimal approaches to get something done. And then thinking it through very carefully and realizing how you are going to pay that debt back, how you're going to recover from that suboptimal situation. So, for example, you may want to have a web app, you know, as a single page web app, but that's hard. The technologies are difficult, right? So you decide in the early days, you're going to have a multiple page app with maybe frames on it or something horrible like that. But then you write that code well, you're disciplined and orderly, so that when it comes time later to improve that website and get rid of the horrible frames, you can do so. They haven't been woven into everything. They're not, you know, everything all tied together and frames are now part of our system forever. No, we've isolated it well. We've designed it well so that we can take that cancerous tumor out of the system and replace it with something better. Technical debt is used as an excuse, right, for making a mess. It should never be used as an excuse for making a mess. Whenever you incur debt, you'd better have a plan for that debt, and you better have looked it very squarely in the eye, like a home debt, like a mortgage, and have a way to get out of that debt.
And any strategies that you can recommend doing that? Or you just recommend like being very aware of it?
Yeah, just be aware of it. You know, be aware of it. I mean, there is this horrible tendency, especially on startups. The startup mindset makes me crazy. I have worked in startups. You know, I understand the urgency and the need and you know, I understand the mindset very well, but the idea that you can break any rule in order to get to market fast is insane. It does not help the startup get to market fast. Usually it slows the startup down to the point where they never get to market at all.
It does. You're right. Coming back to the Agile manifesto once more, was there ever a day when you thought, we created a monster? Like when people refer to Agile as something magical that has a name and people like things with names, right? and that somehow makes their day better, even if it potentially doesn't?
So what happened with Agile is the inevitable response to any new thing. It becomes trendy and people make it popular, and then they have to differentiate it because they need to compete with each other. So they add adjectives and they add new things, and it becomes, you know, bold Agile or weak Agile or yellow Agile or Agile in the trenches. And you get all these interesting adjectives that get added onto it. And that's just what happens. It happens every time. We should expect that it's normal. The message of Agile is still there. It's still there. I just got done writing a book 20 years after the fact, right? Clean Agile. Just to restate the message so that people could go and go, oh, yeah, I remember what that was about. Oh, yeah, okay. Oh, no, I see all these adjectives, too. But, oh, yes, there's the core message. Okay. So I'm not at all – I don't think we created a monster. You know, I think we put a stake in the ground with a little sign on it that had four lines on it. And we said, hey, this might be a good idea. You guys ought to read this. And then we walked away. And that sign is still there, and people can still read it if they want to.
And you would still use Scrum or Kanban or whatever helps in that certain situation?
Oh, yeah. I have no compunction about that at all. My favorite of all those agile processes is extreme programming. Those are the disciplines I would choose to use on any team with some minor modifications here and there. But, you know, that's the kind of process that I would follow, if you want to call it a process, set of disciplines, really.
So your best recommendation, I think, is do whatever works for you, right?
Do whatever works for you, but don't use that as an excuse. You get into this interesting twist, right? Well, do whatever works for you. Well, yes, you do have to do whatever works for you, but you better think it through very carefully and weigh all the costs and understand the repercussions down the line. There is a reason for tradition, and you also don't want to hold the tradition meaninglessly, but you also don't want to abandon tradition meaninglessly. Right? You want to mix the old ideas and the new ideas carefully, thoughtfully, and come up with your own synthesis.
Makes sense. So you would not generally say, use OKRs, use OKRs, or use agile software development wherever possible, right? Okay. Understood. I think that's quite a good idea seeing everything a bit more relaxed. are there any general recommendations, if you could give three recommendations for the CTOs out there? Which ones would you give? Is there anything that really helps you these days?
I have over the years, I've given a number of talks. I think you mentioned one of them, which was called Expecting Professionalism. And the motivation for that talk was to pretend that I was a CTO and then state the expectations that I would have of a software team working in my organization. And those expectations are complete common sense. They make absolute sense to any customer and any manager who has to deal with the software system. And to a programmer, they sound insane. There are all these things that the programmers go, well, we can't do that. Like the number one is I expect that we will not ship shit. Now, everybody agrees, right? Oh, yeah, we definitely shouldn't ship shit. But all the programmers are going, well, yeah, but we have to. There's no way around it. We've got to. And the talk is actually a sequence of expectations like that. And my advice to CTOs is that they manage their teams by those expectations. This is what I expect. Here are some standards. And that's really what those statements are, a set of standards, right? Here are the standards I expect you to meet. You can meet them however you figure out. You know, you want to use test-driven development, you want to use pair programming, you want to use some weirdo discipline. I don't care how you meet these standards. I don't care how you meet these expectations. I expect the expectations to be met. And they're very simple, right? Like, the code actually works every time. And, you know, you've tested everything and you can prove it works. And it doesn't cost a fortune to make a simple change. There's a bunch of very simple statements like that.
Okay. Is there like these days a crazy tool or program you just discovered that you would recommend to all of your friends or you annoy all your friends with because it works crazy good and improves your productivity by at least 100%?
No.
No. No, but anything you love using every day, like apart from Lisp?
What I use every day, what do I use every day? I use a good browser. IntelliJ is my IDE. You know, I've been using that now for 20 some odd years. It's great. So I'm perfectly happy with that. I use Clojure most of the time as a language. GitHub is where I store my stuff. Why would I put it anywhere else? You know, I keep it in Git and I put it up on GitHub. I recently discovered that GitHub has its own continuous integration tool. That's nice. Continuous GitHub testing tool. So yes. Very nice. Now whenever I push something to GitHub, it runs all the tests. That's very nice. I enjoy that a great deal. Are there any tools that I have recently found that affect my productivity enormously? Zoom.
Zoom. Wow.
Pandemic. The goddamn pandemic made us all use Zoom, and all of a sudden everybody is Zooming all around the planet, and I can do talks, and I can give classes, and I can do all these things without getting into an airplane. Now, does that make me more productive? I don't know if it makes me more productive. It changes the formula a little bit. I actually hate it. You know, I hate doing a class over Zoom. The students apparently like it. I don't know. But, I would much rather be there in person. So from a personal point of view, it's like, I wish I weren't using all this Zoom stuff. But it has made certain things an awful lot easier.
Maybe it increases the amount of social interactions and connections you have, but decreases the number of trustful relationships you have, right?
That's a good way to put it. It increases the breadth, but decreases the depth. Something like that. Because now all these people I'm talking to are two-dimensional beings that I barely even see their faces. Mostly I just kind of see they're an icon somewhere.
So you're pretty much looking forward to the metaverse then, right?
I would much rather travel and teach live audiences. And of course, I'm also approaching 70 years old, and I'm thinking, I don't really need to do this all that much more. So, I'll pick and choose the ones I want to do.
Okay. What do you think, and please don't answer with Clojure, is the future of programming? Like, I mean, you've seen a lot. You've seen so many changes in like the way we do software, right? How do we develop software? How do you think it will be in 30 years? Will we all just be integrators? Like all the developers, will we end up as integrators, or how will it look like?
The future of software is the acceptance of the death of Moore's Law. I grew up and spent 50 years in an industry that was in exponential growth. And the level of growth was unbelievable. I mean, it's astronomical in its extent. And, the first electronic computer I touched had 1024 15-bit words in drum memory, right? And now I'm dealing with this laptop here with gigabytes and terabytes and megaflops and gigaflops. The differences are just enormous. That's gone. Gone. The computers are not going to get faster in any exponential sense. They are not going to get more dense in any exponential sense. The laptops we have today are the laptops we had 5 years ago, are pretty close to the laptops we had 10 years ago. The crazy change has ended. In software, we've got this momentum going. We expect things to change. The hardware's not changing anymore, but we keep on inventing new things, new languages, new frameworks. There's nothing new in any of them, but we keep on the churn is continuing. This churn, this turbulence that was caused by the exponential growth in the hardware is continuing in software, and that will end. At some point, the software industry is going to stop the churn, stop inventing new languages, stop inventing new frameworks, and we'll all settle down and pare it all down, get rid of all the chaff and all the gunk, and pare things down to a much smaller set of tools that we all agree are the tools that we all use. And I won't use the word closure, so fine, but there will be a small subset of languages and there will be a small subset of tools. Will we all be integrators? Well, the integration will always be something that we do, but we'll also be innovators. There will always be innovation to do as well. So I don't think those things change. It's important to understand who we are. You know, we programmers, who are we? What do we do? We are the people who deal with the worst details in the world. People hire us because they don't want to deal with details. They hand those details over to us. And we are the ones who write the if statements and the while loops for the most insidious, horrible details that infect everything. And there's no way to get rid of those details. Those details are permanent. They're always with us, and we will always need programmers to write the if statements that deal with all the horrible little things that go on in all of human society.
Great answer. So I still have like a little surprise for you, Bob. So this here, this phone, is actually, it has an unreleased version of iOS that Steve Jobs produced before he, like, unfortunately, left this world.
Shuffled up in mortal coil, yeah.
And it never has been released, but I still have like an unreleased version and carry it with me. And it has a secret app called Time Machine, which I can now open up. And I type in Uncle Bob 1991. And that actually was the year when you founded a company called Object Mentor. I think it was a company for extreme programming training. Is that correct? And we now travel back in time, if you believe me or not, but we travel back in time to the year 1991. And we have the chance to observe young Uncle Bob sitting in front of his computer, building lectures and so on. And you now have the chance to whisper something into young Uncle Bob's ears. What would it be?
Oh, man. What would I tell myself 30-some-odd years ago? What would I tell my younger self to do or not to do? And I would whisper into that young man's ear, pay no attention to me. Continue on doing exactly what you're doing. Because my life is the best it's ever been.
That's a good answer. And it's not the typical buy Bitcoin stuff. So, Bob, thanks a lot. Maybe like you wanna pitch a bit on your courses or promote one of your newest books or something as a closing pitch for your end.
Oh, your people end? Want to know who I am, they can go to cleancoder.com. Cleancoder.com. And I also do videos on cleancoders.com. So just put an S on the end of cleancoder and you'll get to the other website. And that's probably good enough. You can find out everything about me on those two websites.
And then you can meet Bob.
Everything I want you to know.
On Zoom. Remotely or sometimes maybe physical when we're we all want that again, right?
Yes, we do.
Thanks a lot, Bob, and enjoy your day.
Oh, thank you. It's been a lot of fun.
Like, yeah, you're really legend. I didn't promise too much. Thanks a lot. Bye bye. Enjoy your day.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Alpha List podcast. If you like this episode, share it with friends. I'm sure they love it too. Make sure to subscribe so you can hear deep insights into technical leadership and technology trends as they become available. Also, please tell us if there is a topic you would like to hear more about or a technical leader whose brain you would like us to pick. Alpha List is all about helping CTOs getting access to the insights they need to make the best decisions for their company. Please send us suggestions to cto@alphalist.com. Send me a message on LinkedIn or Twitter. After all, the more knowledge we bring to CTOs, the more growth we see in tech. Or, as we say on AlphaList, accumulated knowledge to accelerate growth. See you in the next episode.